Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, state and local leaders plead with you not to light personal fireworks as Utah's extreme drought persists and as the promise of a terrible wildfire season looms. A Utah woman sues her landlord after getting evicted for breaching her contract by voicing suicidal thoughts. And Utah's poet laureate marks a moment in history with a poem about vaccines, hope, and shared humanity. Joining me for this conversation in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Stevens. And thanks for being here, Taylor.
Good morning.
Great to have you here. Reporter Courtney Tanner is with us via Zoom. Hello, Courtney. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
Great to have you here. And also we've got Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke via the Zoom as well. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, good morning.
Listeners, you can actually just a little bit later in the show, we're going to hear from Utah poet laureate Paisley Rechdahl, who published a poem in the Tribune as a kind of commemoration. Stay tuned for that. Listeners, you can, as always, join this conversation with your questions and comments. The number to call, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We are going to actually kick things off today with a clip of Utah Governor Spencer Cox at the state capitol earlier this week. Take a listen.
So far, and again, these numbers are just staggering. We've had 457 wildfires reported. 368 of them, 81% of the wildfires this year, have been human caused. Almost 58,000 acres have burned statewide. About 23,000 of those acres have been the result of human caused wildfires. There were 65 wildfires started by fireworks last year. Let me repeat that again. There were 65 wildfires started by fireworks last year. That's why we're here today. We are urging all of you to exercise extreme caution during the July holidays. Specifically, please, please, please celebrate without personal fireworks.
All right, Taylor Stevens, the governor there saying don't do it. And you know, I don't think we need to linger on this story forever, but it's worth noting that this wasn't just Utah Governor Spencer Cox at this press conference. There were others who were making this this plea. Who was in attendance, and can you just give us the sort of overview of this press conference?
Yeah, so this was the governor as well as some city mayors and council members and fire crews all asking Utahns to exercise personal responsibility. And I think it's important to note that this kind of comes in lieu of widespread action from the government on fireworks. We're in one of the worst drought seasons that we've had in decades, the worst drought we've seen in most of our lifetimes. And, you know, the governor has said that he would like to issue a statewide ban on fireworks, but that he doesn't have the ability to. He's pointed to legislative leaders who in turn point to city councils and mayors. City councils and mayors are kind of divided on whether the state law gives them ability to actually issue a statewide ban. Some have done it, but the legal opinion is sort of fuzzy on that. So, you know, everybody's kind of pointing the finger at everybody else, and now the mantle has landed at the individual level for everybody to, you know, individually exercise their personal responsibility.
I want to come back to, you know, who can and who can't ban fireworks and you know, what might be done about that. But at this press conference, as you said, the governor encouraged personal action. He said that he was optimistic that people would heed his advice, but he acknowledged many people in Utah wouldn't. I guess, what did he say about that? I mean, was he sort of saying, well, people are going to do it anyway, and what are you going to do about it? I guess maybe the question should be, Taylor, if somebody is going to light fireworks, I think the governor had some advice for them as well.
Yeah, so as you said, he does have faith that, you know, some people at least will choose not to light off fireworks. He says anybody who doesn't light off a firework who previously would have, that's a success because that's a potential fire that now won't start. Obviously, if you are lighting off fireworks in prohibited areas, you know, there will be enforcement of that and you could face, you know, consequences. If you light off fireworks in areas where they aren't expressly prohibited, he recommends people have water, you know, on site so they can make sure they can put something out if things go poorly. So that's his advice. But obviously, the overarching message is just don't light them. Save those fireworks for the winter, for New Year's, and go to the professional fireworks where there are fire crews on site to help if something goes wrong.
There is, as I said, just coming back to the idea of getting to the bottom of who can and can't ban fireworks, personal fireworks in the state of Utah. There's talk of changing state code so that personal fireworks bans become automatic under certain circumstances. Can you tell us about that, Taylor?
Yeah, that's something the governor is advocating for. So the state's fireworks code is a little convoluted, and you know, you can see that in the different legal analyses that are coming out right now about who has the ability to ban fireworks. So what the governor would like to see is a sort of clause in there that if an area of the state is in a certain drought designation, that a fireworks ban would automatically go into effect, so legislators wouldn't have to argue or go into a special session. And that's sort of in lieu, I suppose, of allowing cities expressly to have banned citywide. But, you know, it's unclear whether legislators are interested in that kind of approach. We don't really know yet, and we probably won't until next year's legislative session what path they'd like to take.
I'm going to bring Robert Gerke in on this, the news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Robert, we had a hard time way back when getting seatbelt laws enacted here in the state of Utah because seatbelts were an infringement on personal liberties. I guess, you know, what's more emblematic of personal liberties than throwing on some John Philip Sousa marches and trying to burn down your neighbor's house? By which I mean, should, you know, if someone tried to enact a personal fireworks ban, or if the state of Utah lawmakers did this, or would lawmakers be have an appetite for doing this, I guess?
I mean, I don't think they would. I think there's already been some pushback from some lawmakers about the bans in Salt Lake City, Ogden, and other places that are, you know, citywide. I think it is likely that we're going to see some action, but I think the action is going to be the other way, to further restrict the cities to, you know, in the future, limit them in where and how they can ban them. The law that's in effect now is, as Taylor mentioned, really convoluted about, you know, when and under what circumstances these can be banned. And so it does create a lot of uncertainty for cities that are trying to protect their residents. And I think, you know, you kind of hit on this too. I mean, there is just sort of this backlash in the legislature against bans. You know, coming out of COVID, I think that we saw that they rebelled against mask mandates and any kind of, you know, capacity restrictions. And I think there's a libertarian streak in this legislature that would make it impossible, or unlikely at least, for them to give the cities more authority when it comes to protecting residents from, you know, fires caused by fireworks.
In the meantime, of course, climate change is slated to make our region drier and hotter, and to reduce snowpack and stream flows, and also to increase wildfires. And so that's kind of looming in the background. I wonder I guess we'll see what will happen in the legislative session. Taylor Stevens, there's more news to get to here. What else do we need to know here? I mean, there's, as you said, the governor is encouraging people to go to those official fireworks shows.
Yeah, I think that, again, just it's really up to individuals. You know, if you see your neighbors setting off fireworks in prohibited areas, there are some, you know, lines that you can call to report that. You know, the lines that have been drawn in the areas where fireworks are prohibited are those areas where cities have identified that there is extreme risk for fires. But, you know, we'll see, I guess, on Sunday and Monday whether people actually have followed this request, this plea from the governor and from the city and city mayors and city leaders.
It is, it's kind of, I mean, we'll see. It's also sort of frightening, I have to admit, because of the tinderbox conditions out there. Taylor Stevens is state government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and thanks for this. A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. Let's bring in Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner on the Zoom. And Courtney, we will go from pyrotechnics to polytechnic. I need a laugh track here. Let's see. I don't have one. But another story that I just kind of want to quickly get us caught up on is a story that we've been following for a while. Since last year, there has been official movement happening to change the name of Dixie State University. And recently, the Board of Trustees landed on a name that kind of confused people. What was that name, Courtney Tanner?
Yeah, the recommendation, there was this name committee that was supposed to come up with an idea for a new name, and they had landed on Utah Polytechnic State University, which caused a lot of people to scratch their heads, raise eyebrows.
You know, there are schools out there that are polytechnic. What does polytechnic mean, Courtney?
Yeah, it's supposed to just mean like a broad approach to using technology in the classroom. And you're right, there are other schools that use it, like Virginia Tech. The full name of Virginia Tech is Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. And that's what they had tried to model this new name for Dixie after. It just didn't really catch on here.
So there was a bit of a backlash. I know there were some online petitions or a lot of online mocking of the name. And now, though, we have, I think it's a final name for what the school will become. What is that?
Yeah, it's hard to say final because there have been changes and there could still be changes. The new name that the school's Board of Trustees landed on this week is a simpler version. It's just Utah Tech University.
Hmm. Hey, will you remind us why all of this is happening? Courtney, Utah Tech University, probably shortened to Utah Tech, for shorthand, akin to, as you just said, Virginia Tech. Why is this happening? Why is this name change happening?
Right. So this process actually started last year when the Board of Trustees decided that they wanted to move away from the name Dixie State because of the ties that Dixie has to the Confederacy and to slavery. There was concern that students were putting that name, on their resumes and applying for grad school or for jobs. And, people were not wanting to pick them because there was this confusion over, why did you go to a school named Dixie? That's, maybe racist. So there was concern that students weren't really having opportunities because of the name of the school.
Okay. And now that is up for consideration, I guess, Utah Tech. Maybe I'll bring in Robert Gierke just for a quick opinion on this. Utah Tech University. Gierke, do you approve?
I don't know if it necessarily matters if I approve. I think it's, we talked before about the name change generally. I think it's good that they're changing it. I think, whether it's Polytechnic or Tech University, I think it's kind of sixes. They were going to call it Utah Tech anyway. I think there's still a lot of passion around it. I mean, they're still talking about, do they call it the Dixie campus or keep Dixie in the name somehow in some way? There's still some opposition to this name from people who think it doesn't represent their culture by omitting Dixie, but I think it's an improvement. And I think we'll probably see a change and maybe some more changes down the road.
Okay. Courtney, anything? I mean, what's the time frame here in terms of when we might know for certain that this is what the name of the university will be?
So it goes to the Utah Board of Higher Education next to approve. And if it passes there, it then goes to the Utah legislature. I'm not really sure if they would call a special session for this or just deal with it in January, though.
Okay. That is Courtney Tanner, who is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We need to head to our first break in the show. When we come back, though, the story of a woman who is suing her landlord after a controversial eviction. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Courtney Tanner, and by news columnist Robert Gierke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments. Tweet to @KCPW or call 801-355-8255. Courtney Tanner, we will stick with your reporting and news of a lawsuit over an eviction that occurred 8 months ago. So tell us why Austin Sorensen, a student at Utah Valley University, was evicted and why she is suing.
Right. So Austin Sorensen, like you said, you know, a student down in Orem, she was living in a student apartment there, which is actually, it's kind of an interesting setup at UVU. They're not operated by the school, which doesn't have any dorms, but this off-campus apartment, she came out of her room one day and found an eviction notice on the door. And it said she had broken her contract because she had, quote, vocalized suicidal tendencies to her roommates.
And so that was part of the contract. Basically, you're not allowed to tell people you suffer from depression and have suicidal thoughts, or you might lose the roof over your head. That was part of her actual contract?
So the part of the contract that the landlord cites actually is it's an interesting interpretation, which, you know, is kind of the basis of this lawsuit. So the contract itself said that this student breached the quiet enjoyment of the premises and threatened endangerment of human life. So that's kind of the policy that they're citing that this student apparently broke.
How does the law look at this? I mean, I guess the question that I have is, she's suing, and maybe we can talk about what she's seeking in her lawsuit, but how does the law treat this? Does she have a case, I guess, is the question.
So, yeah, I mean, it depends on who you ask. The Disability Law Center of Utah is representing Ms. Sorensen in this case, and they're citing the Federal Fair Housing Act, which essentially protects tenants against discrimination by landlords. And in this case, they're saying, you know, that her depression was a disability under the law.
Okay. What does the landlord say? Or were you able to connect with the managers of this property to find out their response to that?
You know, I have been trying to reach them since October when this first happened, and I have not heard anything back.
And Sorensen, again, as part of this lawsuit, she says she's trying to stop this from happening to others. Is her suit also seeking damages?
She is seeking damages. They're unspecified at this point, but yeah, the biggest kind of request there is that she wants the student housing management to have to go through training to understand what fair housing is, you know, not discriminate against other students. But yes, damages would be included in her request.
And I guess, how, you know, I don't know if we got to the bottom of this, but how essentially the landlords became aware of her situation and how that played out. It seems like a sort of interesting part of the story in that it has to do with the student's roommates.
Yeah, it's kind of a complex story. So go read the full thing, but I'll try to give a synopsis. So Ms. Sorensen was living in this student housing. Her lawsuit said that she was experiencing, you know, depression and anxiety, which she had been diagnosed with. And she was going through a tough time, you know, with the isolation due to COVID that kind of added to everything, compounded it. And so she had written some letters, you know, saying goodbye, according to the lawsuit. She then went to visit a friend, and one of her roommates apparently walked into her room, read the letters, they confronted her, and then they reported that she was suicidal to her to the apartment managers, essentially.
Okay. Just since we are touching on the topic of suicide, I'll mention that if you or someone you know is at risk of self-harm, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline provides 24-hour support at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. I want to bring in the news columnist here, Robert Gerke. And Robert, this is sort of a, I feel like it's a story that I've heard before. I can't actually bring to mind the previous occurrence of this, but I think it has happened before. But a sort of bizarre story. What do you see in it?
Well, I mean, I've always been a little perplexed at how a public university imposes these sorts of restrictions on housing, and maybe Courtney can touch on that a little bit more. But it's the wrong approach to take, regardless of how they do it. I mean, if somebody needs help, if somebody is depressed or suicidal, they shouldn't be punished for that. They shouldn't be, you know, threatened with losing their you know, not having a roof over their head. If they need help, they should get help. And so it's sending the wrong signals. It's providing the wrong incentives. And I think definitely needs to be addressed. And hopefully, I mean, she probably deserves to prevail in this lawsuit, frankly, because she was diagnosed. It is a disability. She shouldn't be punished for that either. So, I think it's unfortunate that it happened. I hope that, you know, the university makes it right, or the legislature makes it right, or whoever needs to step in and make this right or make sure it doesn't happen again, does so.
Courtney, would this lawsuit, I guess what I'm wondering is if this lawsuit would apply to something other than student housing? I mean, would it be, can landlords elsewhere evict people for the same reason?
Yeah, this is, a really interesting area. I think it hasn't been really detailed in the law yet. And I should point out, so Utah Valley University doesn't have any dorms. So this housing isn't owned by the school. It's owned by a private landlord, but it is operated as student-only housing. So she does have that claim regardless.
Okay. I'm just going to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. Again, that's 801-355-TALK. And you can also tweet your questions and comments to @KCPW. I'm certain that you will. Just quickly, Courtney, the time frame on the lawsuit, do we know essentially when things will be in motion?
Yes, lawsuits take a very long time, and this is in federal court, so I think we can expect quite a while. Honestly, that's the best answer I can give you.
Okay. Okay, we're going to turn to some other reporting and kind of somewhat paralleled, I guess, if you live in Utah County, where that story that Courtney covered took place, and you lose housing and you don't have a safety net to fall back on, you might end up out on the street. And so, Taylor Stevens, we will bring you back now into this conversation because you've been doing this ongoing look at homelessness in Utah County, and you wrote a couple of stories with your colleague, Bethany Rogers. One of those stories is that the county has halved its chronic homelessness over the past 3 years. This is Utah County. And I guess maybe can you tell us what those numbers were in terms of how much chronic homelessness there was in Utah County? And then, I guess how significant of a problem is homelessness in general in a region that is sometimes called Happy Valley? How give us that overview.
Yeah, so in a few years ago, 3 years ago, there were 210 people on a list that Utah County service providers keep of people experiencing chronic homelessness in the area. And last year, that register dropped in number from 210 to 104. And so they've about halved that chronic homeless population in Utah County over the last few years. And advocates really credit a housing first approach with helping them accomplish that.
Hmm. And housing first is something that we've heard a lot about for years here in the state of Utah. I feel like I've been hearing less about it in recent years, actually. And maybe I'll ask you this. I don't know if it's actually part of your story, but do you know why we've been hearing less about the Housing First strategy in recent years in the state of Utah? And am I right about that?
Yeah, I think that Housing First got a lot of attention both locally and nationally about 10 years ago when officials in Utah declared that they'd about eliminated chronic homelessness through Housing First initiatives. That got a lot of attention. Of course, that wasn't entirely accurate, and we've written about, there still are people experiencing chronic homelessness on the streets in Utah. But basically what Housing First is this approach to getting people off the streets that basically says, people need a safe place to live, they need a roof over their heads, they need a place that they can land, and then they can begin working on other challenges in their life. So it's not enough to say, oh, someone has to get completely clean off of drugs, or somebody needs to be completely stabilized with their mental health before we get them into housing. What the Housing First approach says is, people need a safe place, a roof over their heads, then they can stabilize and begin working on these other challenges that they might be facing.
You wrote as part of the story that the state of Utah may begin kind of taking another look at the housing first idea because it's something that the new state homeless services coordinator is interested in or is kind of focusing on. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser is our new state homeless coordinator. He's sort of new to this role, sort of getting a lot of tours under his belt and kind of getting a better sense of the conditions on the ground for homelessness. And so a lot of how the state moves forward policy-wise will be up to him. And, you know, housing first is something a lot of advocates agree with. You will sometimes hear people say that housing first isn't housing only, so people still need these supportive services around them, you know, for drug addiction, mental health, other resources that they might need. We spoke to Niederhauser and asked how he felt about housing first. He said that he feels it has merit. He believes that nobody is going to heal unless they have a stable housing situation. However, there have been people who are opposed to the housing first model, and we've seen some of that in, you know, the old, you know, homeless czar on the federal level. He had expressed some opposition to the housing first model. Some people believe that people experiencing homelessness need to, you know, get clean first, or they need to meet certain requirements before they can get into housing. So, you know, there's different approaches to this.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the kind of crux of your, well, or to me, but what I consider the crux of your reporting on this is the difference of opinion over the concept of permanent supportive housing. And basically the two sides of that coin, and they are essentially, you know, requiring people, having these requirements that people stop being addicted immediately or stop having that addiction or have, you know, their strings attached to them showing up in supportive housing. You had two people that you interviewed, of course, as you said, Wayne Niederhauser, who's now the state homeless services coordinator. I don't think he played into this, but Dave Kelly, chair of the Pioneer Park Coalition, and then Robert Vernon, who is the director of Provo's Housing Authority. They have a difference of opinion, from what I understand in your reporting, on whether or not those requirements, those strings attached, should be there. Can you tell us that?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple of different elements to this. One of them being the expense and the cost of this housing first model. You know, there are concerns that it's really expensive to house people for a long time. But on the flip side of that, you know, it's really expensive to have people on the streets. And so this is all around, no matter how you look at it, an expensive challenge, and getting people into housing obviously is preferable to having people on the street. So that's one component of it. And, you know, the other component, of course, is people who think that, you know, people won't be successful in housing if they are continuing in their drug use or they continue to have mental health challenges. So again, it's just really a different approach of, you know, what comes first in order to help people. Right. And most advocates in Utah believe that getting people into housing first and then providing them with those, you know, wraparound services, supportive services, is the right way to address homelessness and put people on the path to success.
Okay, so that's the sort of no strings attached approach, and that's what's happening in Utah County. The chronic homelessness that's been halved in that county was no strings attached for the chronically homeless, right?
Right. And so, you know, in talking with the Housing Authority, which operates these motels, which have been converted into permanent supportive housing units, they say, you know, this isn't just about giving someone one chance. It's about, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth, tenth chances. So if somebody relapses, is doing, you know, abusing alcohol or abusing drugs, that wouldn't necessarily get them evicted. Neither would having like a mental health episode. So we heard one story about a tenant who was having some delusions and pulled all of the wiring out of the unit. And, you know, they kind of had to fix all of the electrical wiring. It was expensive, but it was a medication issue. And so they let this person back into the unit. And so it's really about keeping people housed in the long term, helping people with their challenges. You know, they recognize that this is kind of an uphill battle in some ways, because these are people who have been chronically homeless, have been on the streets for a long time, and, you know, may struggle when they get into housing just to, you know, I worked with a couple for a long time on the streets. I was following them through their process of getting into housing. And when they did eventually get into an apartment, you know, they kept a tent up. on their bed because it was so hard for them to transition back into housing, and you know, they felt claustrophobic. So there's all kind of challenges when people get into housing, but the Housing First approach is really committed to helping people through that process and making sure that they stay housed even if they continue to have challenges.
I remember the story of that couple that you followed. It was moving reporting. You mentioned that the state's homelessness services coordinator, Wayne Niederhauser, former Senate president, is sort of endorsing the you know, a greater focus on Housing First. Has Niederhauser expressed an opinion on whether the state favors requirements, you know, strings attached of people who are providing or who are provided those services, meaning that Housing First would come with those requirements that you quote unquote get clean before you, that I guess that doesn't actually equate to Housing First. I mean, I guess this permanent supportive housing. With strings attached, is that right? Something that Niederhauser talked about?
Well, he hasn't spoken about that, at least in our most recent conversation with him. There were some attempts in the bill that sort of created this new framework for the homelessness, you know, official that attempted to sort of draw some of those, you know, strings, attach some of those strings, I guess, to some of the programming that received state funding, and advocates, you know, argued against that. The next version of the bill that came forward kind of didn't have that in there. That was the first hearing, so we didn't really hear much conversation about why that was removed or what that process was like. But, you know, there certainly are people who have that opinion, and I'm sure they'll be trying to get Niederhauser's ear, so to speak, but we'll have to wait and see, I suppose, how this moves forward in Utah.
I want to bring in the news columnist Robert Gerke. It seems like a good place for an opinion columnist. strings attached or not for permanent supportive housing? I'm putting you on the spot, Robert, but is that even the right question to be asking?
Well, I think it's a question that needs to be asked. I don't know if it's the question to be asking. I think, first off, I mean, Taylor's done terrific work on this reporting, and praise her for that.
Yeah.
I think that the Housing First model makes sense, because I think you've got if you can provide stability, then things like mental health or addiction treatment become a lot easier if you don't have the aggravating factor of not having a roof over your head. So, I mean, and it's also the easiest of the part of it when you think about it. I mean, putting somebody, you know, in an apartment is easier than curing them of addiction or mental illness. So I think it makes a lot of sense that you do what you can do first and then let the other stuff flow from it. Whether strings should be attached, I mean, I think the goal obviously is to get people in a stable, productive environment, sustainable environment. And that includes, I think, getting them the help they need for mental health and addiction issues that might underlie it, and getting them work and getting them, you know, there's, but it all kind of flows from taking that first step, I think. And so, whether that means that strings are attached or that it's just part of the holistic goal of getting people into a sustainable, permanent environment, productive environment, you know, I guess we can have that discussion. But but yeah, I mean, that's obviously the end goal is, you know, helping people get back on their feet.
Yeah. And I mean, Taylor, you spoke to somebody who said that helping people get back on their feet, you know, the permanent supportive housing sometimes did become permanent, meaning endless supportive housing. And that's a difference of opinion there, I think, on whether or not you can get some people back on their feet. And then, you know what, I there's so much more I want to get into, including the story of chronic homelessness in Utah that was solved some maybe a decade or so ago via the Housing First model. But or that was the sort of news headline. But in the end, it didn't look like we actually really did solve chronic homelessness in the state of Utah. I guess there's more to talk about, and there will be more coverage ahead. Unfortunately, right now, we have to head to our next break in the show. Taylor Stevens, thank you so much for your reporting on this. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with our underplayed stories of the week and a recorded segment with Utah's Poet Laureate. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough and with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. This show's our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting and writing from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Well, to save time for a recorded segment, we're going to turn already to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we feature reporting that we didn't cover today or that you might have missed. And Courtney Tanner, are you ready with an underplayed story? And what would you like to highlight?
I am. Peggy Fletcher Stack, our religion reporter at the Tribune, did a really touching story on Carolyn Tanner Irish, who died. She led Utah's Episcopal Diocese as the first woman bishop, and it was a really, really nice story on that.
It was a great story, reviewed her life and her move from Mormonism to the Episcopal faith and so on. It's really a great piece of writing. Check that out at sltrib.com. Let's go to Robert Gerke. How about you? What have you got for your underplayed story?
I'm going to go political. Ali Isom, Governor Herbert's former press secretary, she used to work for the LDS Church, officially announced that she's running for the U.S. Senate as a Republican, challenging Senator Mike Lee. She joins Becky Edwards, former state representative, who's running against Mike Lee. And I think what we're seeing here is sort of a backlash against Mike Lee's sort of radicalism, I guess, and they think there's room for a moderate Republican to challenge him in the Republican Party. And, the Club for Growth, which supports Mike Lee, has already come out hard against both women, sending out campaign mailers, attacks against them. Yeah. So it's already heating up, the 2022 campaign for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate.
Check that out. And a new challenger for Senator Mike Lee. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, we've all been hearing a lot about UFOs recently with the declassification of some documents from the federal government. And my colleague Sean P. Means has a story today about Skinwalker Ranch, which is Utah's home for UFOs and paranormal legends. And he's just got a really fascinating story and some interesting photos. So I'd recommend anybody check it out.
All right, a famous spot of paranormal and extraterrestrial activity in Utah is Taylor Stevens' pick for underplayed story of the week. For my part, I'm going to go with Andy Larson's got a new explainer on the Delta variant of the coronavirus, which spreads much more quickly. Some concern for kids who aren't vaccinated, and of course for the 50% of Utahns who aren't vaccinated as well. It's got some interesting information, including just sort of buried in the data, the fact that I think it's a state official says that we're going to go from, the 500 or 600 cases a day that we're seeing right now back up to about 1,000 or 1,200 cases a day in Utah in the near future. Check that out. And all of the reporting that we've been covering over at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, Courtney Tanner, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Have a great weekend.
You as well. Happy 4th of July. Thanks, Courtney.
Thanks, Roger.
Yeah. Now on the show, we are going to turn to my conversation with Utah Poet Laureate Paisley Rekdal, who was commissioned to commemorate a kind of hopeful moment after a long period of tragedy and lockdown. Take a listen to our conversation. Utah Poet Laureate Paisley Rekdal, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So a poem of yours appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune this week, a sort of commemorative poem to mark a moment in history. And I'm wondering if we can start with your telling us the sort of origin story of this poem, how you ended up writing it. I know that it was a poem that was requested of you, right?
Yes. The Salt Lake County Mayor's office reached out to me and said that they wanted to give a special thank you to all of the vaccination program's staff and volunteers for the work they'd done during the vaccination period, which is, of course, ongoing. And first I balked at it. I said, I don't think they're going to want a poem. It was like, you could just give them a Bed Bath & Beyond certificate or something like that, something more useful. And they said they thought that they would want something that has more historical resonance, something they can go back to, something that speaks to their own memory of the time. So I went and spent time interviewing some of the people who were some of the volunteers, and everyone from National Guards people to some of the vaccinators themselves, and then the people who were volunteers, just making sure everyone was getting through the process.
I'm wondering, you know, I think before we continue in this conversation, would you mind actually reading this poem for us? Because I think I'd like to talk about it, and I want everybody who's listening to be on the same page as well. Would you mind doing that?
Sure. The poem is called What We Thought About Just After the Shot. Tuscany, perhaps, and haircuts, no longer baking casseroles twice a week or delivering groceries to someone else's family. The warm new weight of a cousin's baby or the clarifying light of an afternoon alone. The awkwardness of kisses and restaurants. I thought of my father as a child who almost died of polio, the nurse who berated him into relearning how to walk. I watched a woman in the chair beside me snap selfies, one man twisting in his seat as he tried to thank everyone. I'm flying home, someone murmured, in just a month. Some thought of funerals. Some thought of sons they couldn't yet convince or worried how much the side effects would cost. Perhaps some thought of burning forests of rhetoric and politicians. Most likely considered something simpler yet more complex, how gratitude was now a dictionary written in all the languages of the world. I thought of my husband and my mother's aging body, the scar on her upper arm I'd fingered as a child, pitted, pale, round as the moon whose light, she said, I would see anywhere I traveled, linking her to me and us to everyone.
Again, that's Utah Poet Laureate Paisley Rechdahl reading her poem, What We Thought About Just After the Shot, which appears in the Salt Lake Tribune. I really love that this poem draws that line that connects all of humanity today and through history, or at least through the sort of post-scientific revolution history of our species, because our recent history does have these demarcations before and after the development of certain vaccines. It sounds like your dad got sick with polio before there was a vaccine for that, or before he was able to get that vaccine. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I learned about that fairly late in life. My father was one of those people that was sort of extraordinarily unlucky and lucky simultaneously. He got polio. He had never had the vaccine when he was a child. He'd grown up on a rural sort of farm, basically outside of Seattle. And he got it when he was quite young. And he was very fortunate that he was one of the people that was able to regain all of his physical, you know, strength. Later on, he almost died of typhoid fever, which is another thing that we can be vaccinated against when he was in the Air Force, actually during Vietnam. And so, you know, the history of my family is sort of, you know, ones of coming up against things that could have easily killed some members of my family. And certainly they were vaccinated against. And of course, the scar on my mother's arm is that smallpox, you know, tuberculosis vaccination scar that is very common for some people of a certain age, but right. I think younger readers might not even recognize that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one that definitely links people of a certain age across the globe in that everybody has it. It's interesting, you know, bringing us back to the sort of present day, I went to the Maverick Center for both of my vaccine doses here in Salt Lake County, and there was something so inspiring about the organization, you know, the level of organization that was there, the free access to a public health miracle. And it made me proud of my country and of my community. But there was also that sense of being linked to something bigger, to something monumental. And it was hopeful, which hasn't been the story of this pandemic. You know, it's not been a story of hope. I guess, can you just talk about this sort of collective return as a species to our being hopeful?
Yeah, I mean, I think vaccination is a literalization of that human hope, that way in which our communities are linked to each other. We're linked to each other through disease, but we're linked to each other through science and through cures. And there's one thing that came up over and over and over again talking with the volunteers about their experience was they said, everyone who walks through that door is doing their duty as a citizen of the globe. And I just, you know, I find that moving even to talk about now. I get a little choked up. But I mean, I just thought they saw that as just a real humanitarian and civic project. They didn't see it as like, I had nothing better to do. And, you know, if you read Eulabis's On Immunity, which is a wonderful book, I mean, she sort of talks about this is a, you know, vaccination is a promise you make to other people. You know, this is the thing that you're going to do in order for other people to survive and for all of us to be able to thrive, or as many of us as possible. And I think the thing that's, you know, has been so moving to me about what we're doing now is that so many people want to get vaccinated. And I also have to say the thing that's so dispiriting about it is not everyone seems to want to get vaccinated. And, you know, it makes me, you know, frustrated where it's sort of like, this is an act of hope and faith, and this is an act of community, and people sort of stepping away from that to insist on their private liberties or their independence seems to continue to miss the point for me.
Hmm. I mean, and that's, it's interesting. I mean, there's, I'm getting vaccinated to protect myself is, I think, the way that many people think about it. But of course, as you just pointed out, it's not about that. It's about preventing the spread of this illness to people who maybe for whatever reason can't get vaccinated, but also there's so much more to it. It is this public health measure, a community action, an act of citizenship. I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. I don't know what else to ask you here, Paisley. I mean, personally, I really appreciate the fact that poets like you are marking this moment, this miraculous moment, after a lot of suffering and loss. And it's easy to focus on political debates and on the divisions and on the mistakes. But I think that having reflection from folks like yourself and having a poet laureate in general is an important thing, and your poem helps us remind us of the bigger picture. So with all of that rambling aside, let me just say thank you for writing it. Do you want to talk a little bit about the role of poetry in marking moments in history? Is that too big a thing to ask?
But I will say a couple of things about it. I mean, people are always asking, really, what is the point of poetry? You know, can poetry stop wars? Can it change politics? Can it affect any kind of social change? And that to me sort of misses what poetry really is. It's the writing of human memory, and it is the sharing and transmission of human memory when we commit those poems to heart, or when we share those poems with other people and we take that into ourselves. In that respect, poetry is a bit like a vaccine. It's a communal sort of bond between us, and it doesn't have to affect change on its own. You know, we accept the meanings and the possibilities of poetry, and we are the ones that affect change if we are moved by the poem. And I'm not saying that that's what my poem is meant to do, but I do think of it as a piece of human memory. And one of the things I was thinking about in this poem is trying to record in very quick snippets all the different types of experiences that people might have had during COVID, even though, you know, most of us, there's still so many other stories that are not part of my poem. And yeah, I think that that's the beauty of poetry. It is the continual writing of memory.
Hmm. Wow. I mean, I'm tempted to ask you about specific lines because I would love to pick it apart. There's the line about thinking about wildfires and politics, and I was wondering what was sort of going on in the background of your mind there. Maybe some were thinking of this. What is that a kind of connection to?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked about that one, because I went back and forth of whether I'd even include that moment. But one of the things that really struck me were, you know, during the pandemic, occasionally I'd run into people or I'd overhear people say, this is going to be great for climate change, which of course it hasn't done anything for climate change. But I thought that was a very strange thing to simultaneously have this desire to heal the earth, but it would come at the cost of tremendous human suffering. I mean, lots of people died. Like at the point that I'd heard that comment, about, you know, 2.5 million people worldwide had just died. And I thought it seemed to be simultaneously, you know, politically noble and incredibly callous. But I didn't want to discount that there are some people who are thinking that this is a pause moment, that the pandemic was a way to maybe reset the clock and however they wanted to imagine it. And part of that resetting the clock is about other disasters, the radical fact of climate change that we're living with. And the, you know, response to rhetoric and politicians is, of course, I think, a lot of people were debating about taking this vaccine to a certain extent because of the politics around it, because there was a question of, do you trust the politician who is overseeing the rollout of these vaccine programs? And I have to admit, as much as I thought I would myself get the vaccine no matter what, if it was a different politician at the helm of this, potentially I might have stepped away and said, I'm just going to wait a little bit to see if I can trust this. So I do think that politics is and you know, was part of the decision for a lot of people to get this vaccination. And so I wanted to acknowledge that a little bit, but I also didn't want to come down on one side or the other, because I think it's really complex. I think that a lot of people have very mixed feelings about the last 4 years and about, you know, where we are right now too. So, you know, I think it's all swirling around in there.
Yeah, and the radical effect of climate change that you described also sort of plays into the politics as well. And there's the science discounting the science. Anyway, it's interesting. It's a very interesting poem. And Paisley Rechdahl, I think I'm going to have to cut us off here just in the interest of time. But I will say Paisley Rechdahl is Utah Poet Laureate. She wrote a poem that appears in the Salt Lake Tribune called What We Thought About Just After the Shot. I encourage everyone to check it out. And Paisley, thank you for making time for this.
Thank you very much.
Again, you can find Paisley Rechdahl's poem and everything else that we've been covering on the show today over at sltrib.com. And that does it for our show today. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Podcasts can be found at kcpw.org or through whatever app you use to get your podcasts. Have a great holiday weekend. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.